From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, hidden symmetry is at the heart of why we're all here. We'll learn why that is. Then Milwaukee Magazine searches for some of the most creative people in town.
In this case, it wasn't what you would think of as creative. We wanted to open it up to people who were doing things, not necessarily strictly visual artists or people you would consider an artist.
Learning to appreciate fall migration and the birds around us all the time.
You know, you don't have to identify a bird to appreciate that it's out there. And that's especially important during migration when you never really know what's going to show up.
And we'll catch up with Milwaukee's mobile soup specialists aboard the Simmer truck. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. Academics struggle with some pretty big questions depending on their field. Philosophers, for example, might ask, why does anything matter? While for physicists like Dave Goldberg, the question is, why is there matter? Goldberg studies and teaches cosmology at Drexel University in Philadelphia, but when he's not teaching undergraduates, he's trying to make this material comprehensible to everyone. Goldberg is the author of the recent book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. Lake Effect's Bonnie North reached Goldberg by phone and asked him about one of the most curious ideas he raises, that we owe our existence to a minus sign.
I think one of the things that people are often surprised by when they learn about science, when they learn about the laws of physics, they see one thing happen after another, and everything sort of seems deterministic, like one of these classic Rube Goldberg machines. But I think one of the problems is that we don't realize how much the universe seems to be fighting against our very existence. And I'll give you an example, the one you're alluding to, which has to do with something that we see called antimatter. We're able to generate it in the lab. People have heard about it from science fiction. It sounds very dangerous because antimatter, when it comes in contact with ordinary matter, completely annihilates. And so one of the strange and sort of surprising things is that in many respects, antimatter is almost exactly the same as ordinary matter, to the degree that if we turned all of your atoms into anti-atoms, as long as we did the same thing to the rest of the universe, then we just wouldn't know the difference. Physics behaves exactly the same.
Okay.
But there's another important part to this. I said that matter and antimatter annihilate. They annihilate completely, one atom for every anti-atom and so on. But we create them the same way. Every time we've been able to create a particle, we create its antiparticle at the same time. So the big question is, if we always create them in equal quantities and we always destroy them in equal quantities, why haven't they completely canceled each other out in the first few seconds after the Big Bang? Why are we left? Why is there matter at all? So matter and antimatter form this great symmetry in the universe, but it turns out that it's not quite perfect. So this little tiny, and it's literally one part in a billion, this little tiny distinction, one we've never been able to directly replicate in a lab, between matter and antimatter, is literally all that allows you to exist, because otherwise we would have been completely annihilated. There are no anti-people. There are no anti-galaxies, as near as we can tell. There's just us, this tiny little extra bit, basically, in the universe.
So that broken symmetry is something that, again, as I was reading the book, and I am not a physicist, I'm not a scientist, coming to it just out of interest and trying to understand better, you know, the universe that we live in, it seems that broken symmetry is required in a lot of different places in order for, as you say, for things to happen.
That's right. So, I mean, I've already mentioned the symmetry, the asymmetry with regards to matter and antimatter. There's another one that's, I think, important and really surprising, which is that, for the most part, if you do an experiment on a microscopic scale, and you look at all the interactions of particles, and you take a little movie of it, if you run that movie in reverse, basically the flow of time going the opposite direction, that movie looks perfectly valid. The physics looks perfectly fine. And this points to something really kind of weird. As far as the laws of physics are concerned, there is no arrow of time. The laws of physics don't intrinsically know about what is the future and what is the past. So there's a symmetry there, too. And yet, we clearly know that the future and the past are different, just like we know that matter and antimatter are different, and we're the one and not the other. We know which one is the future and not the past. There's a different sort of symmetry breaking, one that we understand, at least, in sort of a very basic way that comes from something known as the second law of thermodynamics, which basically is the idea that things get more complicated over time, or things fall apart, or things become more disordered. And so the big, I guess, fundamental question, one we do not have the answer to, is it that things become more complicated over time, or does the arrow of time go in the direction in which things get more complicated? And we honestly don't know the answer to that.
Do we have any best guesses?
Yeah, a lot of people have best guesses. Unfortunately, for the most part, they generally tend to pick one or the other. Some very, very smart people think that the flow of time, the direction of the flow of time, is caused by the increase in entropy. I must say, I don't share that view. I tend to believe that the direction of the arrow of time is something that's inherent, and then it so happens that entropy increases with time. Entropy is this disorder that I talked about earlier. The reason that entropy increases with time is it's something that's just very, very likely to. You know, you start off with coins, for example. They can either be on heads or tails, and if I have 100 of them, and they're all initially set to heads, and I come along randomly and just start flipping them over one at a time without looking, as time goes on, they'll get distributed more and more, 50-50 heads and tails. They'll become essentially more uniform. Basically, it will increase in entropy. But that's just random chance. So when we're told, you know, in our introductory physics classes that there's this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, the reality is it's actually just a very, very good suggestion, not really a law. It's something that's incredibly likely to happen, that entropy will increase with time. For my money, since it's just something that's very likely to increase with time, ridiculously likely, with many, 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 many zeros, since it's just something that's very likely to increase with time, it's hard for me to imagine a scenario in which time itself is governed by the increase in entropy.
Okay. Well, in telling the stories, one of the things that you talk about in the book are black holes, and you talk about positioning our Alice on the edge of the event horizon on the black hole. And, you know, a lot of us, particularly those of us who love science fiction and, you know, do popular science reading and that sort of thing, you know, love the idea of black holes and want to understand them. And, oh, you know, everything gets sucked into a black hole and that there's all kinds of fun stuff. But you take that and you play with that. And yet after reading that chapter, I understood so much better what's happening at the event horizon, just before the event horizon, in the black hole itself. And I think maybe you're onto something.
Well, first of all, thank you. Those are very kind words. Secondly, for your listeners, you mentioned Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass come up a lot in this book because, of course, Lewis Carroll played around a lot with the idea of how things look in the mirror, obviously, but also how things look in just slightly different worlds where you change the rules seemingly ever so slightly, and played around with games like chess, but played around with those ideas of these symmetric games and flipping things around. So Alice ends up being a proxy a lot of the time. But it's absolutely true that you know, trying to sort of imagine yourself in circumstances like falling into a black hole, or how that would appear, or why it would appear that way, and why falling into a black hole really isn't that different than a lot of the physics that we experience every day. It's just more extreme. I think that's a perspective that many people might not have seen before. One of the heroes, in fact, probably the hero of this book, is a little-known mathematician named Emmy Noether.
Yes, and I was going to bring up Emmy Noether because she is probably someone that most of us haven't heard of. I certainly hadn't before I read your book, and it seems that what she did contributed in a fundamental way to our understanding of physics in the 21st century.
Oh, she absolutely did. So for your listeners who aren't familiar with her, and by the way, you're certainly not alone. I did a poll of Twitter followers and Facebook followers and my own students and even some of my colleagues, and many didn't know who she was or vaguely knew who she was. There are very few who really had sort of committed Noether's theorem to memory or really understood it. And she's incredibly important. So first, just a quick biography. She's an almost exact contemporary of Einstein. She was not allowed to study at Erlangen, which was the university in her town in Bavaria, actually where her father was even on the faculty. She was only basically allowed to audit classes and had to take a final exam remotely, sort of on her own, a final at the end of her 4 years of education, entirely because she was a woman. Eventually, she'd get her PhD. Having done so, she was invited to Göttingen University to work on her mathematics by some of the giants of the age. But again, because she was a woman, she wasn't there in any official capacity. She wasn't paid. She was allowed to lecture only under somebody else's name. But she produced this incredible, incredible body of work. Mathematicians, I think, revere her. But she's also produced something incredibly important for physicists, and that's this Noether's theorem. And Noether's theorem basically says all these symmetries that I talk about throughout the book, they have real consequences in the real universe. They create conservation laws. And conservation laws are physicists' bread and butter, and they can be explained very simply. You know, suppose you have $50 in your wallet, you spend $10 on lunch, you don't need to look in your wallet again to know how much money you have left, right? The money you took adds up to, and the money that remains adds up to what you started with. And the same is true for lots and lots of quantities like energy, momentum, electric charge. And what Noether did is she basically gave a way of computing, of figuring out what all of the conserved quantities in the universe are. And so if you come up with a new theory, and people do this all the time, people are trying to merge, you know, come up with so-called theories of everything and grand unified theories. If you come up with one of these theories, you basically, they're all built around symmetries. And so Noether basically says, here is exactly how you can figure out all the conserved quantities. It sort of provides the pathway to figuring out new particles, new interactions, and all of that. And it really just stems from this very basic idea that she came up with and developed. Incredibly, incredibly important. And it's an incredible shame that I think she's not better known.
History is certainly full of people who do important things like that that we then build on. But it seems like this was so important and yet not recognized.
It's hard to understand entirely why. I mean, part of it is she died quite young. You know, also, of course, the gender played a huge role in it. And I think there's also, I mean, obvious comparisons can be made with Einstein. Einstein, of course, early in his career was unrecognized. You know, he was working in the patent office until he had his great breakthroughs. But I mean, there's also a different style to their writing. I mean, Einstein wrote his papers in such a way to say, hey, I had this great idea. Let me explain it to you as I understood it. And he really does. He walks you through it sort of step by step by step. Noether, I think, in many respects, was such a genius that she said, look, you know, I'm assuming other mathematical geniuses are going to be reading this. So here's the math, and good luck to you.
Yeah, which would have left me out completely.
I got to tell you, I found it very, very difficult to read her papers as well. I mean, they're not even just written for scientists. They're written for mathematicians.
Right. Well, I have to say it is a wonderful book, Dave. I really appreciate the attention that you put into it and the fact that you managed to reference a lot of science fiction and Comic-Con and a few other things that I have to say you made me laugh out loud when you said you started a paragraph with, you know, when you watch Star Trek, parentheses, and you did.
Well, hopefully I know my audience.
Dave Goldberg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Dave Goldberg's latest book is called The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. He teaches in the physics department at Drexel University in Philadelphia, and his other works include A User's Guide to the Universe. He spoke with Bonnie North. The flap continues over the Health Exchange's website, launched by the federal government as part of the Affordable Care Act. But that comes on the heels of the complaints by many Republican lawmakers about the act itself. Lake Effect essayist Avi Lank says much of it can be traced back to a basic demand some would like to place on government.
Ever since the Reagan administration, there have been increasing demands that government be run like a business. Even something as unbusinesslike as higher education has been roped into this thinking. with public universities coming under increasing pressure to show how they provide economic value, rather than how they fulfill their traditional public good of leading the intellectual progress of mankind. Such thinking is misguided. Governments and business have vastly different goals. Business exists to make a profit. Governments exist to provide goods and services that are either not economical for businesses to provide or are so important they should not be produced just for profit. Measuring a business's success is thus easy. Does it make a profit? Measuring the success of a government is much more difficult. Start with how a government decides upon its goals. In the U.S., this is complicated and messy, a process that allows many interest groups to influence the outcome on the theory that public discussion will result in an outcome that serves the greatest good with the widest support. In business, a chief executive can decide upon a goal and then assemble a team that lets her pursue it with no cross purposes, which brings us to the embarrassing rollout of Obamacare. If the government were run as a business, there would have been no such embarrassment. Once the chief executive settled on the goal of providing health insurance to all Americans, the government as a business would have found the most efficient solution. In the U.S., that would be slightly tweaked Medicare or Medicaid for everyone. In business terms, a simple brand extension of mostly successful products. But government is not a business. Its decision-making is not so easy. So instead, our system behaved as it was designed and came up with a government solution. It is beside the point that Obamacare is the ultimate proof of the old saw that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. To curb the potential power of government and to make sure the voices of multiple interests were heard, our system is designed to produce unruly camels instead of swift, beautiful horses. The difference between government and business also becomes apparent in how the challenge of harnessing the resulting camels is approached. Were the government run as a business, then contracting would be much simpler and responsibility much more clear-cut. Consider the fate of Ron Johnson, not our esteemed senator, but rather his namesake, the former Apple executive hired to redo the JCPenney retail firm. Johnson had the power to dictate huge changes in how Penny did business, but he did not do the detailed work needed to make the change successful. The result was a disaster, and Johnson was unceremoniously ousted after just 17 months. Like Johnson, President Obama did not keep close enough track of efforts to implement his signature program. But the president will not lose his job over it, because in American government, the chief executive serves a fixed term. This is how the system is designed, in part as a reflection of its shared decision-making, and in part to give the chief executive the ability to take unpopular but necessary decisions. Furthermore, if government were run like a business, then the chief executive would have the ability to modify a program to make its implementation easier as logical fixes became apparent. But the U.S. government is set up so that the president needs congressional approval for such fixes, and in the case of Obamacare, the system made that impossible. In addition, the Supreme Court used its power to make implementation of Obamacare even more difficult by ruling that states could decline to expand Medicaid under the program, as was originally planned. Both are examples of the checks and balances written into our system that make it impossible for government to be run like a business. Yes, those checks and balances add to government mess and create inefficiencies. Government, our founding fathers decided, is too important to be treated simply as a business.
Lake Effect essayist Evram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 35 years. He lives in Whitefish Bay and freelances for a variety of publications. Who are the most creative Milwaukeeans, and how are they affecting the quality of life here? Some perspective when we return on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Who are the most creative people in Milwaukee? And how does that creativity affect the lives of the rest of us? Seems like a pretty straightforward couple of questions, but creativity means different things to different people. And when you get down to it, there is creativity to be found in some unexpected places. Milwaukee Magazine went in search of creative Milwaukee recently and found 20 people that best exemplify the city's creative spirit. The result is the cover story in the November issue. Claire Hannon edited the feature that profiles the 20 creative Milwaukeeans, and she's with us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, so let me ask a real fundamental question and maybe an overly broad one, but work with me here. What was the definition of creative you were working with? Creative could mean so many things.
That's a great question, because in this case, it wasn't what you would think of as creative. We wanted to open it up to people who were doing things, not necessarily strictly visual artists or people you would consider an artist. So we wanted it to be a much broader term, and it was just people who were taking whatever field they had and were doing something totally inventive and innovative.
Well, and so take us on a behind-the-scenes tour of how this came together. You know, there's some people that you'd think of, well, obviously these guys are creative. They're artists. This is what they do. Their job is being creative. But how did you brainstorm where you were going to turn to find people like a psychologist or a guy that does bicycle tricks?
Yeah. Actually, it started as an idea that I just threw out in a brainstorming meeting, and I put pretty much no thought into it. And Christina, our former editor, was like, yeah, let's do that. And so then I had to put some thought into it. But the final list came about through a bunch of staff meetings where we just sat there and I made these huge PowerPoints with tons of people in them. And we kind of just went through and talked about the merits of each. We also asked for submissions from our readers, and we got many. I was surprised by how many we got. And some of those reader-submitted creatives were actually made it into the book.
Well, and beyond that, this isn't just 20 creative Milwaukeeans. Uh-huh. You make the case that they all, in their own way, enrich the fabric of Milwaukee.
They do. And there is a whole lot of talk about that going on in the city. And it seems like the last year has just been a whole lot of talk. And we wanted to really spotlight the people who are doing and who are walking the walk. So I think all 20 of these people definitely do that.
Well, and we should make a technical distinction here because lest anyone think that you are anointing these as the 20 most creative people in Milwaukee, the title is actually 20 of the most creative Milwaukeeans.
Yeah, that's on purpose. We didn't want to have a definitive list because hopefully there are way more than this.
Because I would feel overlooked.
I'm sorry, Mitch. Next year.
Well, and so we alluded to this, that there are obviously a lot of people in what we might think of as traditionally creative fields, the artists and writers and filmmakers. And, and we'll talk about some of those in just a minute. But let's talk about some of the people in these other fields, like, say, the epidemiologist that's profiled.
Yeah, Mallory O'Brien. She does a whole lot of work with crime statistics, and she kind of looks at how crime is related to certain other societal factors, family upbringing. But she gets down to, of course, the minutiae of your family upbringing, and she kind of finds these correlations and says, well, what if we worked on fixing this piece of minutiae? Would that lower the crime? And in some of the cases that she talked to Kurt about, that approach really worked.
This is editor Kurt Chandler who wrote this particular part.
Yes.
And as you might expect with somebody who crunches numbers, there's a way to quantify this. You can actually look and see that that crime statistics in particular areas dipped.
Yeah, definitely. She works closely with the police department, and from what we've heard, it really seems like they trust her methods and have employed a lot of them.
There is also a psychologist in this that is profiled, and I will say I have heard about her work, though I have never seen it in person, but it is a pretty creative approach to psychology. This is someone who does not wait for the clients to come to her.
Nope. She brings it to them, and I think, tries to eradicate that fear factor and any sort of stigma of going to a psychologist and turning it into a social thing and an anonymous thing where you can get feedback and advice about whatever kind of problem you have.
She does these sessions called
Shrink and Drinks.
Shrink and Drinks.
Yeah.
And she her name, by the way, Julie Helmrich.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess people fill out cards with their questions and she kind of takes it on in an amusing and non-threatening way.
Yep.
in a restaurant.
Yeah, and so you can kind of take your glass of wine and submit your question anonymously and she'll go through and pick a bunch of them and then start conversations about them and give her professional opinion. She's also a traditional psychologist and you can see her one-on-one if you'd like to. But we just thought this approach was something we hadn't seen before and is a totally innovative way to bring a service that people might really need but might be afraid to ask.
You yourself wrote two of the specific profiles for this piece. One is on Heather Hambrecht, who we might look at as one of those people who you might expect to be creative. She you label as the seamstress in hiding. Tell us about Heather.
Well, that was a little pun on animal hide, Mitch. But
nicely done.
Thank you. She uses leather from four different tanneries. One of them is local, and she creates these really interesting purses of all different sizes. She also makes these leather garments, which are nothing like anything I've ever seen. Her garments are all sizeless because she thinks the sizing system, the American sizing system, contributes to self-esteem problems. The purses, which is what we have a beautiful picture of, are all very purposefully designed, and she can explain a use for every single little nook, cranny, and pocket in all of these purses. So that the purse can, like, help you get through the day. And I've never, of all the fashion people I've talked to, I've never heard someone explaining what she does in the way that Heather does and how they're really supposed to help you and not just be a pretty accessory, which they are that as well. So.
Well, and I don't know if I'm reading this right, but do I gather she will soon be one of Evanston, Illinois' most creative people?
No, she's not moving. She's just opening another location.
Oh, okay.
Because she sells a lot of her stuff in the Chicago area, so it's kind of just to help, I guess.
The other person you profile is Nikki Johnson, and
yeah.
Nikki Johnson falls under the category social sculptor.
Yes. Nikki is listeners might have heard of her because some of her works have been picked up in a national way. Her Eggs Benedict was the portrait of the former Pope Benedict made of condoms. And that's the one that got all sorts of controversy. But she made the sculpture because she wanted to – she was so struck by his statement that condom use increased the spread of HIV. And her next sculpture, which I thought was absolutely breathtaking, was this – life-size sculpture of Michelle Obama's arms, and she draped this beautiful scarf on the arms. And the sculptures are life-size, and they all kind of point to the media's fascination with Michelle Obama's body and this focus on her arms and how she's kind of been reduced to her body type. So really powerful statements in these sculptures, and she was telling me about some of her upcoming work, and I mean I can tell you that they are going to be just as controversial and impressive, and I can't wait to see them.
So that's Nikki Johnson. We made reference early in this interview to a gymnastic biker, and I thought we should at least mention Tim Knoll in this.
Yes.
Because especially I gather the assignment was to send Howie Magner out to see if he could learn one of these tricks.
Indeed, that was. Part of putting this feature together was I wanted readers to see that not only are we profiling these creative people, but we can also be creative ourselves in writing about them. So some of these are written in very experiential ways, like this thing about Tim Noel, where I asked Howie to go and let Tim teach him a trick. And Tim Noel basically said, absolutely not. It's not safe for Howie, who has not ridden a bike in a while. But he just bought one, so I guess that counts.
But there are some impressive, I gather, impressive videos of Tim Noel doing these
bike
tricks.
He does the craziest bike tricks I have ever seen. And they get millions and millions of views. The picture we have is one of him, like, gliding under these semi-trucks. It's – I mean, you have to see it to believe it, kind of.
Well, and you mentioned experiential – you mentioned some unconventional storytelling. We should at least make reference to we should make reference to the one profile that is written in – I don't know that it's iambic pentameter, but certainly in poetry form.
It is a poem, actually, written by Dasha Kelly, who is a local poet. And she wrote about Milo, who is a local rapper. He's a really young guy, kind of making a name for himself. MTV has picked him up, LA Weekly, and he raps about normal young guy things to things like David Foster Wallace's writing. So he, I thought, if we're going to write about him, I want someone who is a spoken word poet to write about someone who sounds like he's a spoken word poet.
What do the people you profiled think of being included in this feature? Do they see themselves as the creative Milwaukeeans?
You know, some of them, I think, like the visual artists, you know, see them definitely do. But so far, no one has sent any hate mail or said, no way, I'm not creative. So I think they like it. This issue came out. We had a launch party and a lot of the subjects came to it. And this was the first time they were reading that story, which for a journalist to see, to in person witness the, you know, your subject reading about themselves, it's really nerve-wracking. But they were really nice to our faces, so I assume they liked it.
Do you feel like you got some overarching message about creativity as you compiled this?
I hope we expanded the definition for sure, and I think we did. And I think for the people that are doubting all this like hullabaloo about creative this and that and blah, you know, what does it really mean? Let's blow up a car. These are the people who are doing it in a way that works. And yes, some of them are creating art, which we do need, but others are creating things, you know, like plays for elderly people to help them remember better.
Well, Claire Hannon, thanks so much for sharing this story with us. And we hope Lake Effect will be included next year.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Claire Hannon is an assistant editor at Milwaukee Magazine and edited this month's cover story on 20 of the most creative Milwaukeeans. There is a link to it from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Another break now, but keep listening. A primer on bird migration through southeast Wisconsin when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Hopefully, you remember to set your clocks back an hour over the weekend as daylight saving time came to an end. It's lighter out than when we woke up a week ago, but for many of us, our commute home is now through the dusk. None of this is the slightest bit relevant to the birds who still chirp first thing in the morning and who are still passing through Wisconsin on their way south for their annual migration. Ken Keffer and Stacey Tornio are our outdoor adventure contributors, and they join us now to talk about the fall bird migration and more about birds in general. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Always great to be here.
So it's the beginning of November. Most of the human snowbirds are probably still in Wisconsin as opposed to on their way to Arizona or Florida at this point. But that does not mean there aren't other things that are heading south through this part of the world. The birds have been on their way for a while.
Indeed, yeah. You know, migration's a fascinating topic. And so when you think about it, we kind of oversimplify things. We say birds fly south for the winter. But that's not always the case. You know, we've got birds that stick around all year, and it doesn't happen instantly. It's not like we turn on the migration switch and then all the birds up and leave overnight. You know, I mean, shorebirds started migrating south in July. So fall migration has been happening since the dead of summer.
But what are the determining factors for when some birds, you know, why some birds would leave in July and why other birds would wait until October?
Yeah, you know, each of those species has a different response, you know, and part of it's just habitat. A lot of it's food based, you know, what are they going to be eating? And so, but the thing that really drives migration is photo period. It's how long those length of day is. So as the days are getting shorter, that triggers the kind of the physiology for these birds to up and leave. And so, yeah, it's different for every species though.
Well, what can you tell us about what we ought to be looking for and when?
So one of my favorite things to look for is, like, you know, as bird migration is starting to come about, like even before that, you can start looking for young birds in your backyard. And so these, like, kind of clumsy youngsters that look like adults, but they're not really adults yet. And so they kind of, like, the other day I had a brown thrasher at my feeder, which is kind of a cool bird. And he was sitting on the feeder and he kept kind of like falling off. And it's like, oh, that's a young bird. And so I, you know, grab my son and I'm like, look at that. He's about your age, Jack. And so to kind of put it on his level. But it's just kind of fun to, like, see what's out there. Like, you're going to see things right now that you're not going to see at other times of the year. So it's just a good time to kind of be on the lookout.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You know, and I think the other thing to remember is you don't have to get bogged down on the details of each species. You know, just pay attention. You see the birds flitting through your black hole. Look at the colors of that thing. You know, you don't have to identify a bird to appreciate that it's out there. And that's especially important during migration when you never really know what's going to show up.
How much do we have to do to attract these birds to our yards?
Feeders will attract some birds, like always during this time of year too. I tell people to use this opportunity to go on a hike somewhere. Like, we have great nature centers around Milwaukee. Go to Ware Nature Center, go to Schlitz Audubon Center. Just go to the lakefront. There's some really cool birds that just show up at the lakefront as they're going through. And, you know, take the opportunity to see what's out there. But then as far as birds in your own backyard, Ken has some good ideas on, like, what to put out to and see what you can attract.
Really just think about what birds need to survive. It's not that different than what we need. You know, you're talking food, water, shelter, space. And so you can put out a little bird bath. You can put out a bird feeder, you know.
Do I understand that there have been some really unusual birds for this part of the world that have already been through the area yet this year?
Part of the thing that people get excited about when they're watching birds is the anticipation of what we're going to find, you know, and things show up. There was a report of a monk parakeet hanging out in the Milwaukee area earlier this summer. And on the surface, the first thing you think of is like, oh, that's got to be an escaped caged bird. You know, somebody's pet got away. But there's a population of parakeets that hangs out in Chicago, and they've been established there for like 40 years. And so I'm sure what happened was this was a young bird out exploring, you know, and that's not going to be a migratory species, but they're still going to move around on the landscape. And so this one showed up in Milwaukee. So, yeah, who knew you could see parakeets in Milwaukee?
You mentioned the nature centers. Do you have other places that are your favorites to go and check out birds?
Well, just in general, like, the lakefront is always a good spot. I mean, there's trails, the Oakleaf Trail. Anywhere on the Oakleaf Trail is fantastic. Just jump on there, take a little walk and see if you see any birds. And then back to, like, your backyard, you know, you're going to get, like, spring is really heavy. You're going to see a lot of birds in spring. Then you kind of get a little bit of a lull during summer because birds are, you know, they're mating, they're having babies, they're off, you know, being busy raising their young. And so now is the time where those young start coming out. They start, you know, flying south for the winter. And so this is like a great time to see action in your backyard, even if you haven't seen it, you know, a month ago.
Yeah, and I think the other thing to remember is, you know, I mean, I said that shorebirds start in July. Some of the later migrants, you know, are like the ducks and the geese. And those are big, visible birds. You can just find any open water. You don't need binoculars. You just go out there and be like, wow, look at all the different kinds of ducks swimming around out there. It's a really cool thing to see.
Their ultimate aim is to find open water. They'll go as far south as they need to so that there's open water, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing when we talk about migration is when we say south, some birds, Milwaukee is south for the winter. And this is their kind of tropical destination all winter long. And ducks is a great example of that.
Yeah, dark-eyed juncos. You'll see dark-eyed juncos showing up in the fall. And so whenever people see those, they're like, oh, no, here comes the snowy weather.
Do you each keep track? Do you have life lists?
I don't have a life list per se, but I did something this year that, you know, just because I'm new to the area and I wanted to force myself to get out there and explore new parts of Milwaukee. And so I'm doing a Milwaukee County big year, and I'm counting all the species I can find within the county. And I'm going to a bunch of different parks and stuff. And, you know, here we are kind of to fall migration. I'm at 116 different species of birds so far this year. And there's going to be some more that come down for this kind of late fall and winter. So, you know, I'm hoping to add a few more to my list.
Yeah, 116. That's not bad. And what did you hear the other day that your last bird that got counted?
Yeah, the most recent bird on my list was an eastern screech owl we heard kind of winnowing in Greenfield.
Yeah, and those are all over Milwaukee County. So, like, look up eastern screech owl, like, online and see what they sound like. It's not what you think necessarily. And so it's kind of cool to know that and be listening for that.
Outstanding. Stacy, Ken, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are the authors of The Kids Outdoor Adventure Book, 448 Great Things to Do in Nature Before You Grow Up, and they are our outdoor adventure contributors as well. One last break, and then we'll catch up with the proprietors of the Simmer Truck, the city's mobile soup purveyor. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Back in June, we spoke with Steve Perlstein, former journalist turned chef, whose latest venture was a food truck specializing in soup. We spoke with him after his first recipes had come together, but while the truck itself, called the Simmer Truck, was still a work in progress. 5 months later, the truck has become a staple on Milwaukee's growing food truck scene, and so we thought it would be worth a trip down to street level one day when the Simmer Truck was parked out in front of the Chase Tower. We caught up with Steve and his wife, Jennifer Block, as they geared up for the lunchtime rush. Thank you so much for having me in your truck.
Well, thanks. We're happy to have you here. Last time we talked, the truck was under construction, if I recall, so there was no truck to stand in. And we're very happy to have a truck and have it operating.
It was a gleam in your eye.
It was a gleam in a garage in Ohio at that point. It was about halfway done.
Yeah, now we've been operating for about 3 months, a little over 3 months.
All right, well, so let me ask you the obvious question. Compare the dream of doing this with the reality of doing this.
It's a lot of work, but we knew it was going to be a lot of work, but we didn't realize quite exactly how many hours. But it's fantastic. We love the flexibility. We love being able to go where people request us to be.
For me, the best part of it has been how gratifying it is that we've done this and people have responded, and we've been able in a pretty short amount of time to be successful at it.
Well, and this is obviously not your first foray in the food world, but were there things that you did not know that you have learned since you've got this up and running?
I never in my food life have I ever had to deal with truck maintenance. You have the kitchen, and you have the issues that come with the kitchen, because, you know, you're standing in a fully licensed commercial kitchen right now. But then you have making sure that you have enough propane, and you have the engine braking, and you have to worry about oil changes and things like that. So for me, that's kind of the new part of it.
What about you? What is the steepest learning curve for you been?
Well, I had mostly learning to work in the space that we have. It's a pretty good size in here because it's wider than a lot of trucks, but just getting working together and coordinating our movements has been the most difficult.
It's only been 25 years. We hadn't figured that out yet.
Well, and who would think that there is a certain amount of choreography that has to go into working in a kitchen?
Well, there is, and, you know, the interesting thing is, compared to other trucks, as Jennifer said, this is much wider. So we really have good space here. And there's only two of us. A lot of trucks had three or more people. But still, I mean, you know, you have to make sure that you're not running into people or that you're not stabbing each other, because, you know, we have sharp knives here. And
the interesting part is when we're really busy, we tend to work better together, just because when we're not as busy, we're trying to both do everything. We have our own little roles in here.
When it really gets humming, when there's a lot of, there's a line, and we have you know, tickets up here, and we have food to cook and food to get out. We kind of like fall into the routine. It's always better to be busy, and that holds true for space and time management as well.
How do you feel you have connected with the food truck universe in this city? The customers that are getting used to trucks being out there, and you know, finding your niche along with all the other trucks that have sprouted up really just in the last year or two.
Well, there's a couple of parts to that. First of all, the food trucks here are pretty close in the community. We get along really well. We help each other out. We got a text from one of the other trucks the other day. They had an event they were committed to. They couldn't make it, so they called us, and we took care of it. And you know, there's a lot of that goes on. There's a lot of working together. There's a lot of sharing space, ingredients, holding parking spaces, whatever. So that's great. And we've definitely, I guess for me, I can't speak for Jennifer, but what I imagine would be our biggest revenue sources and what I imagine would be more successful for us is not necessarily what's come to pass. We're making much more of our money from catering than I thought we would, which is great, and that's starting to take off. It's just been a pretty steep learning curve, at least for me.
We've also been asked to sort of change our menu to some extent. We've added a lot more gluten-free soups, a lot of vegan products, just because we've had such a demand for that kind of thing. So people are seeking us out because we have the gluten-free cookies, and we have gluten-free soups every day, and vegan soup every day, vegan panini every day.
Well, and I think we talked about this in the studio, the idea of doing this and the idea of it being different from a restaurant in the sense of being able to change your menu on a fairly quick turnaround. And has that proven to be the case? Is it easier when somebody starts saying, well, wait, hey, how about making a gluten-free soup that might include this ingredient? Is it fairly fast to turn that around?
Yeah, and we've done exactly that. What if our menu items have been food suggestions? We've had some that have definitely
the vegan paninis have been. We did a grilled veggie for a while. Now we're on to the Southwest tofu panini. We added the veggie meal in a bowl, so we always have the, right now it's a quinoa salad.
Yeah, and Jennifer came up with the idea to do gluten-free cookies, and we started with gluten-free chocolate chip, and you know, people have really warmed to that, so we've expanded to a couple other kinds of gluten-free cookies. So, and it's just nice to be able, as we thought we would be able to, it's nice to be able to say, okay, so you know, we had a beer brat panini, which kind of sprung out of a conversation with customers, and we did that, and it did well, and we were mulling stuff around, and Jennifer said, "Why, you know, we should try a bacon cheeseburger," and literally 48 hours later, we had bacon cheeseburger paninis on the truck, and they've been doing really well too. So that's been really fun, and you know, we just talk about what we want to do, and then we do it.
Yeah, we've always had the creme brulee on, and we added the vegan creme brulee because I decided I wanted to find a recipe that looked good, and so I played around with that at home and baked them up, and they tasted really good. So those sometimes sell better than our regular creme brulees. It's fun just having a variety on the truck.
How about the whole building a brand aspect? How well known do you feel you are, and how hard has it been to develop, you know, Simmer Truck as something people know what it is when they hear the name?
I feel like we've really done well at building the brand. People know us when they see us driving down the street. They know us when they see us parked on the street. They talk about having seen us in X, Y, or Z place. People seek us out. We did an event in Oshkosh, the Tough Mudder Race, which was amazing, and it was just this huge thing, and 25,000 people. And we've had people come to the truck here in Milwaukee since then who discovered us there and now have found us here. So we took the time and the expense to make a really nice logo and to really brand the truck, and I think it's paid off with people really, really noticing us and remembering us.
How ready are you for the weather to turn colder, and how well is this truck likely to do in the snow?
I think we're going to do really well. I mean, we've already in the last couple of weeks, we've seen like an increase in sales in soup, definitely. People are buying larger soups, they're buying more soup, and definitely in the offices around here, people are asking us if we're going to be out all winter and are excited about that because most food trucks are not.
Plus, we're trying to really expand our catering, so that can be a good piece of our winter. We've done some backstage catering at Turner Hall already. We're going to be doing more of that. We started doing lunch deliveries to offices, and we're working on doing a lot more of that. We're booking holiday parties now, which is, you know, definitely something that's been picking up. So in addition to being out on the street, which we can do because, you know, we park the truck indoors, nothing's going to freeze unless it's zero out, and then we'll take that day off. And we're really working at rounding out our offerings so that we can stay busy even when we're not on the street.
And at some point you have to really hope the city does a nice job of clearing the curb space for you to be able to fit in the spaces.
I think we're going to need to have a shovel on board. I've definitely thought about that. We need to find a nice small shovel that we can stash and use when necessary.
I mean, are you concerned about running into trouble when there is a snow emergency declared?
There are definitely going to be days this winter when we can't go out. We can operate down to a certain pretty cold temperature, but below that, it's going to be too cold. You know, if there's a blizzard out, we're not going to be able to go out.
Nobody's going out anyway, so we'll be okay.
Right. So there'll be days when we're not going out, but there'll be a lot of days, I think, when we can go out and sell, and that's kind of where we're headed with that.
How long does it take to get used to the heat in this kitchen?
It hasn't been as bad as we thought it was going to be. It's a lot better than other trucks because it is an old school bus. We have windows on both sides, and that cross ventilation makes a huge difference.
In fairness, I'm not really dressed for it.
Yeah, and it's not that hot on here compared to how it could be.
Well, we don't even have all the windows open today, and we have some small fans that we can turn on to blow at us.
Yeah, it's not as bad. I mean, there are trucks that get oppressively hot. I mean, really, really 110, 120 degrees hot no matter what. This truck doesn't do so badly. And, you know, we have a nice hood which draws the heat out pretty well. And the windows work, and it's a kitchen, so it's going to be a little hot.
Well, Steve, Jennifer, I'm going to let you get ready for the lunch rush, but thanks so much. Best of luck.
Thanks, Mitch.
Okay, thank you.
Steve Perlstein and Jennifer Block are the husband and wife team that run the Simmer Truck, a Milwaukee food truck specializing in soup. We spoke with them aboard the truck while it was parked in front of the Chase Tower, where our studios are located. You can find a link to where to find the truck each day from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. So now that we have you hungry for lunch, that's going to be Lake Effect for a Monday. Tomorrow on the show, we'll meet a second grade teacher honored as one of the top young teachers in the business. Plus, the Public Policy Forum looks at schools across the region. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Have a great day. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.